MSW Media.
If Donald Trump becomes president, we need to take him at his face value, as we should have taken Putin at his face value.
Prevail. Це щотижнева програма про політику.
L'histoire, la sécurité nationale.
Crimen organizado, dinero sucio.
Глобальну корупцію та боротьбу за демократію.
І ahora.
А тепер.
Et maintenant.
Con ustedes, su anfitrión.
Gregolier.
Welcome to the fight. This time I know our side will win.
I'm Greg Oliar. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Alexandra Hall is here. If you like what I'm doing on the podcast, please subscribe, review, download, and share episodes with your friends. My column, Prevail, on Substack has been going since November of 2019. Lots of stuff in the archives about all kinds of horrible people. Leonard Leo, Jared Kushner, Vladimir Putin, Trump, and lots of geopolitical stuff too about Russia, Ukraine, and lots of other places besides. Every piece at Prevail is free to read, always will be, no paywalls ever. Your generous support keeps it that way. Subscriptions remain just $6 a month, $55 a year. Visit gregoliar.substack.com to learn more. For more than 30 years, Alexandra Hall worked as a diplomat in the British Foreign Office with postings in Bangkok, Delhi, Bogota, Tbilisi, and the kookiest place she was asked to serve, Washington, D.C. She resigned from the Foreign Office in December of 2019 during peak Boris Johnson because she felt unable to represent the government's position on Brexit with integrity. She is the co-host with Jason Pack, who's been on this show, of the Disorder podcast, which I highly recommend. I've learned a lot from that podcast, the guests that they have on. It's really good stuff. So please subscribe to that. Alex is also a big fan of the Baltimore Ravens of the National Football League, losers to the Kansas City Chiefs in the AFC Championship game this past year. I'm titling the episode Around the World in 80 Minutes because we really do go kind of around the world. We talk about Georgia, the country, because I was interested in that. Just, it's not a place you hear about very much. I didn't know very much about it. And I wanted to, get her insights on what the place is like, especially with the relationship with Russia there, so close to it in the Caucasus. And, you know, Joseph Stalin is from Georgia. So, what's Russia like there? What's the relationship like with Putin, all that stuff. I wanted to hear from her about that. I asked her about Britain because I'm still kind of puzzled by, this parade of kind of inept prime ministers. Sunak seems to be the best of the most recent bunch, which is not, it's a very low bar. So I wanted to get her thoughts on that, the job that he's doing, and when the election maybe is going to be, and we can clear out this Tory government kind of thing, which seems to be what is going on. So I got her thoughts about that. And of course, about Brexit, because she had a position in D.C., she was a liaison to kind of explain the Brexit positions to people here. And the Brexit positions make no sense. And she felt that there was a point at which she could no longer do the job with integrity, and she resigned, which is a big deal. If a diplomat resigns after 30 years of service, it's a big deal. So we talk about that, and we talk about Brexit and the implications with the EU. I ask about Northern Ireland. We talk about the coronation and the monarchy. She wrote a great piece about the monarchy for Byline Times, and I wanted to get into that and what her thoughts were about that. We talk about Putin and Navalny, and obviously we have to talk about the Israel-Hamas war and the role of diplomacy there, which I ask her about as well. Really good answer she gives on these topics. So very happy to have her on. Really grateful to her for delving into things in such a detailed way. And it's just a great conversation, which you will enjoy and which I will have for you in a minute. And one thing to keep in mind, I should put up front, we recorded this on February 17th, which is 3 weeks ago. So not much has moved significantly in world affairs, although the situation obviously in Israel, Hamas has gotten worse, but I don't think it impacts her answers at all. But just to keep that in mind, that we were recording this 3 weeks ago. I feel like the last like 7 years, you know, the whole Trump era from the time he, you know, came down that idiotic escalator and called Mexicans rapists, even though he's the rapist. See how that goes? Projection. I feel like it's been a roller coaster. And I know that's kind of a, you know, cliche, it's a roller coaster. But what I mean by that, it's more of a wave. It goes up, it goes down. There's periods when you feel like, oh my God, we're doomed. And it's periods when you feel like this guy's finally getting what's coming to him and people are finally learning the truth and figuring this all out. And right now we're in a, you know, we're in one of those troughs, it feels like. It feels like all hope is lost. It feels like the Supreme Court is totally in on this guy. It feels like that alien canon, this Marco Rubio appointee, God knows where they found her. She's presiding over the documents case. And I remember a friend of mine who's a lawyer said the documents case should be the easiest thing on earth to try. You know, you bring in one witness, the FBI guy. Hey, did you find the stuff there? Yes, we did. Case closed. He took the stuff. He's not allowed to. You know, he's guilty. This is not, it's not any debate about the guilt here. He can argue about the laws and this and that. But the bottom line is like, you know, it's a cookie jar. Your small, tiny fingers are in the cookie jar and they're not supposed to be. End of discussion. So this is it's not going to be a big deal case. It's not complicated like the RICO case in Georgia. It's not kind of abstract like the one in New York. It's not going to require you to prove or believe that Trump instigated and encouraged the insurrection like the one in D.C. This is the most open and shut case. And it's also the worst one because he's giving freaking national secrets to God knows who. If you don't think he's been monetizing our national secrets, I don't know what to tell you. The guy, he monetizes everything. Everything he sells. So to think that the most valuable thing he's ever come into possession of, that he's not going to hawk it to the highest bidder, which is going to be the Saudis or the Russians, probably. You're crazy. It's just, it's you know, willful ignorance at this point to think otherwise. So it's a huge national security implication here if this case doesn't come out. And there's one person, Aileen Cannon, Marco Rubio found her, God knows where. God knows who she is. We've never even seen another picture of her. It's just the same dumbass smiling picture that we always see. Who is this woman? Why is the press not investigating her? Because she's clearly corrupt. Sorry, she just is. She is absolutely in the bag for Trump. And there's no question about it based on her behavior. So investigate her, please. Come on. Anyway, it feels like we're in one of these troughs. You know, it was, if there was Star Wars before, this is one of the Empire Strikes Back periods. I am assured that there will be a return of the Jedi. The Jedi are coming, you know. Maybe it's just wishful thinking on my part. Maybe it's denial of reality on my part. But it feels to me like Trump is not going to be expanding his vote. I don't feel like he's going to get more voters now that he's a rapist and an insurrectionist and a guy who stole, you know, national documents and stuff, classified secrets. I just don't think that's going to happen. And maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just putting my faith in the basic goodness and intelligence of the American people. And maybe that's a bad bet to make. Was P.T. Barnum who said, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American public. I don't know. I feel more hopeful about it. I just do. I think that, you know, it's still very early. It's only March. People have not started thinking about this yet in earnest. And when they do, they're going to be like, oh my God, this guy's even worse than we thought, because he is even worse than we thought. Once you get up on the stump and start, you know, comparing yourself to Hitler and say you're going to be a dictator, I don't know. It feels like maybe that's a bad thing. So the election's going to be a referendum on Dobbs, as I've said many times. That's what I think it's going to be. I think that most people think that that's really important and that the government trying to control all women is really important and more important than anything else. So, you know, hopefully that comes to bear. And I know the polls are close and this poll here said that the polls have been wrong constantly, like consistently wrong. So I don't believe the polls necessarily. I believe them to the degree that, you know, I don't think like Dean Phillips is is popular. But, you know, to the back and forth between Trump and Biden, God knows what questions they're asking or how many people or who they're even calling. You know, I don't believe it. We still have to get out and vote. We have to vote in great numbers. But Jedi's coming back. That's all I'm saying. So, all right, enough of my prattle. It's Around the World in 80 minutes. We'll be right back with Alexandra Hall. Hall.
Jenny, Jenny, she's the coup planner. Clarence loves her, but we cannot stand her. Samuelito will do whatever she says. She wears corruption proudly, like her scar from her mess. She's tight with Leonard Leo, dark money Barry side. And when it comes to SCOTUS, Jenny Thomas on 6 of 9. Jenny Thomas on 6 of 9. Jenny Thomas on 6 of 9. Jenny Thomas owns Clarence, Amy, Brett, Sammy, Neil, and John.
Alexandra Hall Hall, welcome to Prevail.
Thank you so much.
I'm super excited to talk to you today. And just to introduce who you are to the listeners, you're the co-host of the Disorder podcast. And we've had Jason Pack on this show before, so my listeners will know who he is. Before that, you were a diplomat for the British Foreign Office for 33 years. You've been to Bangkok, New Delhi, Bogota, and the wackiest place they sent you, Washington, D.C. And then you were the ambassador to Georgia. Right, exactly. You get time and a half for that one. you were ambassador to Georgia, and I want to talk about that, too, because I think that's an interesting place. And then you were the Brexit counselor at the British Embassy in D.C., basically trying to explain to the American people what Brexit was and why it was a good idea, even though no one in Britain could really figure that out or create the talking points. So you resigned. You resigned your position in December of 2019. And we're going to get to all that. I want to hear about all this stuff because it's all interesting to me. What a diplomat is, what the job entails, what you've done. You've written some things that got me to think about it. I think it's pretty fascinating. So, but before we get into that, how did you get into this line of work? Did you always want to travel to other places? Do you speak a lot of languages? Like what led you to do what you do for a living?
Well, there's an unserious answer, which is that when I was graduating university, I had a friend and we were staying with her parents. And the parents were talking about the son of another friend of theirs and saying, it's marvelous. It's simply marvelous. He's going into the Foreign Office. Just marvelous. And I thought, oh, that sounds rather good. Why don't they say that about me? When I had my career advice at university, they told me I could be a social worker because I filled in this questionnaire and I said I wanted to do good in the world. And so they recommended I be a social worker. But the more serious reason is that I did international politics at university and I specialized in the Middle East. And I spent a semester at a university in the West Bank called Birzeit University, and I was doing a dissertation on the Israeli Arabs. And I visited many refugee camps. I stayed with a friend whose family were refugees in Gaza. And I thought, I need to join the Foreign Office, and I am going to solve the Middle East peace process. It was a slightly conceited attitude, but it motivated me enormously.
I think that it's not conceited. I think it's idealistic. And I think that having the attitude is the right way to go. Unfortunately for you, Jared Kushner already solved the Middle East crisis. So, you know, nothing left for you to do.
Yeah.
So you were the ambassador to Georgia, the country, not the state, which is, do people make that joke all the time to you? I don't know.
Yes, they do. And there's a good joke there about how in one of the Olympics, apparently, the state of Alabama was absolutely outraged when they discovered that a team had been sent from Georgia.
That's funny on so many levels. yeah, I like that one. That's a good one. Okay, put that in the memory bank. So I wrote, actually, the last novel that I wrote was a 700-page book about the Byzantine Empire, which amazingly did not sell very well. But the main character, or the sort of focus character, is Maria of Alanya, who was a princess of Georgia. This is the mid-11th century. Her father was King Bagrat. So Georgia has been around for a long time. They were a vassal state of the Byzantines before Russia even got its shit together. So talk a little bit about Georgia as a place. Like, what is it like there? What are the people like? How is it different from Armenia, which is sort of close by and similar in my mind, but obviously different? And what's the deal with their relationship with Russia and Putin?
Well, the first part of my answer, I'm going to sound like the tourist board for Georgia, because it is a stunningly beautiful country, nestled in the Caucasus Mountains, but with beautiful, rich, fertile valleys between them. It is the cradle of wine. It is believed that wine started being produced there 8,000 years ago. It has the most unbelievably delicious food. It has fabulous music that stirs your soul, and a form of Georgian dancing involving daggers that, after you've watched a display, you want to go out and fight Russians because it's stirring and motivating. They have the most fabulous history. So as a place to work and live, it is beyond compare. As a country, I was incredibly lucky to be posted there from 2013 to 16. It was a really optimistic time. It was the one country in the post-Soviet space that had successfully had an election and a democratic transition peacefully. It had a relatively open society. It had a free press. It had ambitions to join the European Union and NATO. And as a result of its war in 2008, when Russia invaded and grabbed 20% of Georgia's territory, it had got the attention of the world, and it had strong support from the EU, from NATO, and from the US. So it was a very stirring and encouraging time to be there. It differed from Armenia and Azerbaijan, its two immediate neighbors, in that it really was felt to be the sort of beacon of democracy in the region. I mean, Azerbaijan is still under the leadership of the Aliyev family, rich through their oil and gas, but impoverished in democratic terms. It's a very authoritarian regime. And Armenia, just as beautiful in Georgia in many ways, was absolutely dependent on its relationship for Russia. It had a sort of long-standing security relationship with Russia, and Russia was perceived to be its backer in its long-running feud with Azerbaijan. So Armenia just couldn't go quite as far forward in terms of its relationship with the EU or with NATO. And if it had hints of democracy, it was firmly suppressed by Russia. So Georgia was really the beacon in the region. It was a really great time to be there. Sadly, that has changed. Georgia has been sliding back in democratic terms. And I would now say that Armenia is beginning to overtake it. And Georgia has been ruled by the same party, the Georgian Dream Party, since 2012. The elections have been held under questionable circumstances. The former president Saakashvili has been held in prison for several years and is looking increasingly gaunt. And Georgia has failed to respond as robustly as other countries to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And some would say it's been hedging its bets with its relationship with Russia. So Georgia has taken a distinct turn away from its democratic path.
Is it the president that's in jail? Is he did he do bad things, or is it just like kind of BS jail thing, like a Navalny thing?
Yes, I think he did do bad things.
Okay.
Georgia has a history of belief in strong men coming to sort of save their country. So Mikhail Saakashvili came to power in the Rose Revolution and was the bright face of a new, young, aspirational democracy. He ousted peacefully Eduard Shevardnadze. And there were, for the first few years of Saakashvili's presidency, there were some amazing reforms undertaken. The police force was completely scrubbed and rebuilt, and corruption was pushed back, and new civic institutions were established to serve the people. Investments were made, new roads were built, and Georgia seemed to be this buzzing, developing place. But I think it is a legitimate criticism that Saakashvili and his supporters got used to the trappings of power. And in order to stay in power, they started using some fairly repressive methods against their opponents. In their efforts to combat corruption, they would sort of put the squeeze on businessmen and threaten them with prison. And just on the eve of the 2012 elections, absolutely shocking videos were leaked on the internet revealing quite considerable abuse of detainees in Georgia's prisons. And so, yes, some rather dark things happened under Saakashvili's later years. But to his credit, I'm not saying this is a high bar to pass, but to his credit, he conceded defeat in the 2012 elections and allowed the new Georgian Dream Party to take power. So in the end, he upheld that sort of core tenet of democracy.
Which is more than we can say for the last president that we had in this country. So yes, that's a...
Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned strongmen and that being part of the culture. How is Stalin perceived there? Or is do they embrace him, or do they like, no?
So one of the sort of alleged tourist sites in Georgia that a lot of visitors like to visit is there is a museum in Stalin's birthplace in the city of Gori. Now, as British ambassador, I felt it would be really inappropriate for me to go and visit that museum.
Yeah.
So I never visited it, but they have a sort of ambivalent sense about Stalin. For some Georgians, you know, he's the most famous Georgian that ever existed. So there is a certain connection there. There is also a sense that Stalin was Russia's leader during World War II, and Russia suffered immensely during World War II. Millions of its citizens died, but it put up a plucky resistance to Hitler's army. So there is a certain pride in that history. And Georgia gets beamed a lot of propaganda from Russia. And Russia under Vladimir Putin is playing up the Soviet Union's heroics during World War II. It's part of Putin's own propaganda narrative about the heroics of the Soviet Union. So some of that infiltrates into Georgia. And so I think there are older generations that have that certain memory of when Georgia was kind of a treasured place within the Soviet Union. If you are a younger Georgian, you're looking far more towards the EU and the West, and Stalin is a memory of an older repressive time. So there are sort of ambivalent attitudes. When I was ambassador, I used to go to Europe Day celebrations and commemorations of World War II, and there would always be a handful of people who would be carrying pictures of Stalin or putting flowers on monuments, Soviet monuments. So there is a legacy there.
Yeah, it's interesting about the Russian propaganda filtering through, because it comes through on Fox News too. I know that there seems to be a revisionist history of that, where I remember Sean Hannity tweeting out like, Stalin was our ally in World War II. He's not so bad, or something to that effect. It's like, he killed more people than Hitler, but okay, Sean Hannity, you know, you do you.
Yeah. And I mean, in Georgia, you know, all the older Georgians speak Russian and they have memories in the slightly less repressive phases of the Soviet Union of Russians coming to holiday on the coastline in Georgia, visiting their beautiful cities like Batumi and bringing a lot of money. And as a result of the tensions between Russia and Georgia and Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008, trade relations were suspended for many years. They've been restored under the current government. But that really hurt Georgia's economy.
Sure. So now you said they're hedging their bets. I mean, it seems like maybe they would be next if something happens in Ukraine, or is that not something that you think Putin is targeting?
Well, my worry was that if Putin got really pushed back and defeated in Ukraine, there was a soft target where it could tighten its grip in Georgia. It could formally recognize the independence of the breakaway territories of Abkhazia and South Ossetia, or it could formally annex them as part of Russia. The issue was whether this would be done with the connivance, tacit acceptance of the current Georgian government or not. Under Saakashvili, there was absolutely no way that this would be accepted. Under the current Georgian Dream government, I do worry that they feel if Ukraine is not going to win, and if the EU and NATO ultimately are never going to let us become members of these bodies, maybe we just have to reconcile ourselves to our neighborhood and reconcile with Russia. And so the hedging of bets is partly as a result of a sense how strong and how deep is EU and NATO support either for Ukraine or us. I mean, when push comes to shove, will they really defend us? And, you know, I'm not trying to make excuses for the current Georgian government, but I do feel there is a certain logic to their position in the sense that we're already seeing that hesitation in Congress on the Republican side to give that latest tranche of funding to Ukraine. You've seen Hungary holding up EU aid to Ukraine. There has been a certain reticence about what kind of weapons we should give to Ukraine, how far and how fast, and what kind of weapons we should give. When push comes to shove, are we willing to risk our own security for the security of Ukraine and Georgia? So there's a little bit of realpolitik, but I do feel the current Georgian government also has more of an affinity towards Russia and more of a suspicion of EU and NATO than the previous Georgian government did. But make no mistake, the Georgian people at large really dislike Russia. There is still amongst the Georgian people at large a strong affinity towards the EU and NATO.
That makes sense. Well, now also the you mentioned the Armenian being defended by Russia and having that relationship. That obviously this past year just completely collapsed in Nagorno-Karabakh.
Absolutely.
So that I'm sure that has some that's affected the thinking in Georgia as well. Because, you know, now, I don't know, maybe Putin's word isn't worth something. Maybe it is. I don't know how it would be perceived. It seems to me that it would be perceived as this guy doesn't, you know, come through on his promises.
Well, Russian propaganda plays on many different aspects of Georgia. It plays on the fact that Georgia has tried to join the EU and NATO for many years and has been held a little bit at a distance. And so Russian propaganda can say, look, they're fickle friends. They're not really your friends. They're never really going to deliver. And the fact that it is a little bit of democratic backsliding within Georgia itself that is also delaying Georgia's membership of the EU and NATO, you know, that doesn't really resonate, but Russia can play on that. They're never really going to come through for you. They've been promising it for years. Look at Turkey. They haven't let Turkey into the EU. Then they can play on the sort of cultural differences. The EU is always going on about gay rights and trans rights and identity politics, and this isn't part of our tradition, and they're going to undermine your sort of more conservative values, and that plays into it. And of course, it plays into it when the EU insists that Georgia passes anti-discrimination laws that include not discriminating against gay people. And the Georgian Orthodox Church tends to be very skeptical about matters like this. So they can play on many, many different levels.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how it shakes out. Thank you for explaining all of that. This is a good time, because I always forget to do it, to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Alexandra Hall Hall.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp Therapy Online. For 10% off your first month, go to betterhelp.com/Greg. You know, a common misconception about relationships is that they have to be easy to be right. Therapy can be a place to work through the challenges you face in all of your relationships, whether with friends, work, your significant other, anyone. I mean, we live in a world now where a lot of our social interactions take place online, which is strange, right? Because for thousands and thousands, hundreds of thousands of years, human beings have been on this earth. There's not been Facebook or Twitter, you know, for all this time. And now suddenly we've had to adapt to how to deal with this. And stuff comes up online because you know this person, you think you know that person. It's very confusing. You know, there's no template for it. We've never had this challenge in all the time that we human beings have been here. So who do you go to talk to about that? In my case, I went to BetterHelp, and it helped me a lot. It really helped me get through a hard time in my life. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. One of the nice things, it's entirely online, which is great actually for therapy, because I feel like sometimes there's an awkwardness in going somewhere and you have to go find somebody and you have to talk to the, it just takes a long time to get therapy going. It's hard to find a good therapist. So with BetterHelp, you don't have to wait nearly as long. You fill out a brief questionnaire, you get matched up with a licensed therapist. You can switch if you need to, but you're going pretty quickly. And when you're out looking for a therapist, it's usually because you need a therapist. You want to talk to somebody, you know, sooner rather than later. So that's a great benefit of BetterHelp. It's flexible, it's convenient, it's suited to your schedule. I used to do my my sessions in my car on my phone, like at lunch hour, and it worked fine. It worked great, and it really helped me get through a rough patch in my life, and it can help you too. So become your own soulmate, whether you're looking for one or not. Visit BetterHelp.com/Greg today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Greg. Start living a better life today.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money that'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing on the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.
Okay, we're back with Alexandra Hall Hall. Before we were talking about Georgia, now I want to talk about your home country of Great Britain and specifically your role in this Brexit thing. As an Americans are in no position to say anything, because I've long thought that, you know, Brexit and Trump, two countries, same op, same timing, it's the same thing. But you were tasked with coming to the United States and basically being an ambassador for Brexit and explaining it and trying to make sense of it, even though from what I see as an American, I don't think anybody can really make sense of it. It seems like from where I sit, since Brexit happened, there's been an attempt in British politics to have a prime minister who agrees with Brexit, but is also smart and competent. And I don't know that such a person exists. That seems to be what we've learned so far. But you resigned. You couldn't handle the sort of what you felt was the duplicity of the government there. And you thought the whole thing was kind of a bad idea. So you were put in a position where you had to resign your position. And you wrote a great piece about this for the Texas National Security Review, where you sort of examined and went into depth examining diplomats and other people who work in politics, also in the United States, too, in the Trump administration, and when they left, why they left, did they stay, is it better to stay or go? These sort of probably eternal questions. So I want to talk about all of this stuff, but take us back to December 2019 when you resigned, because at that time, Theresa May's already gone. You've got Boris Johnson there, which was a bad idea, I think, from the moment, you know, you knew that was going to be bad. I mean, it was,
the train wreck was coming.
Yeah. Is he friends with the Russians? His name is Boris, you know, I don't know. So, but you're in this position. What's going on there? Because there's things in the piece reading it that I either I had forgotten or I didn't know. So talk a little bit about what's happening in Brexit specifically at that time, just so people can refresh our memories.
All right. So just to back up very quickly, I wasn't put in this position of being Brexit spokesperson. Fool that I was, I actually lobbied for that position to be created and then applied for the job, because a little bit like my overinflated ambitions about resolving the Middle East peace process, I genuinely thought, I may not personally have thought Brexit was the most brilliant idea, but if we're going to do it, let's at least do it competently.
Yes.
And let's at least explain it rationally. And at the time I applied for the job, it didn't look like the UK was either explaining it coherently or delivering it in a sort of strategic or logical way. And in the US, everybody was scratching their heads. You know, what on earth is going on in the UK? Why are they making such a mess of this? And I thought, well, if I'm in the embassy, I will understand what's going on in Whitehall, why the decisions are so complicated, and what the real inside story is. And then, based on the fact that I've worked in US think tanks, I've taught at US universities, I'm married to somebody who worked on the Hill, I've worked in Washington for many, many years, I will be able to explain it in a coherent way, and I will be doing my patriotic duty. What I did not expect is when I actually got into the job, not only was there the political dysfunction that we appeared to see on the outside, completely the case on the inside. What happened is when Boris Johnson became prime minister, it wasn't just we were trying to explain things that were very difficult. We were actually tasked with telling lies about the implications of Brexit. And that was the turning point for me. So he became prime minister in August 2019. And almost immediately, the sort of lines to take, the sort of talking points, the messages that were being sent out to diplomats around the world explaining our policy on Brexit took on a way more political tone than anything I had seen before. And we were being asked to downplay the impact of Brexit on the situation in Northern Ireland, to pretend that we could have our cake and eat it, that there wouldn't really be any implications for trade between the UK and the EU, that American businesses with investments in the UK, there would be no problem for them continuing to trade in the same way into the EU. And it became increasingly hard for me because I would be going and meeting people who had invested millions of dollars in a new production facility in Ireland or in the UK. And it was the whole investment was premised on using that as a jumping off point for trade into the EU. And they would be asking me, what are the terms of the deal that Johnson is negotiating with the EU and what impact will that have on our business? And my talking points were sort of, it'll all be fine. But everybody knew that Johnson was determined to leave the single market and the customs union. It explicitly meant that there would be non-trade barriers set up between the UK and the EU. It wouldn't be trading just as normal. And I knew that. The point was, the American businessmen I was talking to knew that because they're businessmen and they have representatives in the UK. They understand trade. And you know, I know there's this canard that diplomats are sent abroad to lie on behalf of their country, but we're really not. You know, we do try and put a positive spin on what we're doing, but we're not actually there to tell lies. And I couldn't do it. I mean, I found it really difficult to do it. And then I would go up on the hill where there were a lot of people who were interested in the implications for Brexit on the peace process in Northern Ireland. And again, the lines that we were being given from London were, we're committed to the peace process and we commit to there being no border re-established between the Republic of Ireland in the south and Northern Ireland in the north. But there was no explanation about how we could square that with leaving the single market and the customs union, because there would have to be some kind of border checks there to check goods transiting. And I would be asked by staffers regularly, so how are you squaring that circle? And the lines would just be, well, we're committed to upholding peace. We're committed to upholding peace. And it was just impossible. And there were sort of example after example. I mean, a third example was that at one point, Boris Johnson's government was threatening that if we can't get an acceptable deal with the EU, we'll just leave the EU with no deal at all, which would be absolutely catastrophic overnight for businesses. It would be catastrophic for travel. I mean, we had people wondering, would planes fall out of the sky? Would planes be able to land? Would all travel stop? What about if you're stuck? Would you still be able to study? Would you still be able to live? Would everybody have to sort of cross borders like in a sort of India-Pakistan partition scenario? I mean, the questions were endless. And not only would the government refuse to share with us their inner analysis of the implications of that, but again, we were sort of given lines that, well, it'll all be fine. And I mean, these were just not sustainable lines. But in September, I submitted a private official expression of concern saying, I don't think these lines are acceptable. They're not usable. They're not credible. I'm not going to say they're outright dishonest, but they're certainly misleading and they're not being listened to with any credibility. And I submitted that private complaint. And to their credit, the Foreign Office privately took this up with Number 10. And there were efforts to give us more sort of credible lines. But the politicians continued to just say what the hell they wanted. So I would go and give a briefing to a university or a business group, and I would draw from my official lines. And the first question would be, well, then why is your prime minister saying that? And again, there was no sort of coherence. And so by about October, I was fairly confident I was not going to be able to leave. At the end of October, there was a deadline of, if there's not a deal with the EU, we were threatening to leave without a deal. And I didn't want to jump ship at that point. We got over that hurdle. We got an extension of a deadline for negotiations with the EU. An election was called in the UK, but I knew I had to leave before the election because I didn't want to look like my resignation was because I didn't like the result of the election. So then it was just a matter of when I left, and I knew it had to be before the election, but it was a tough thing to do. I mean, I was ending my career.
Yeah, no, it took a lot of courage to do it. In your case, I think the leave was the right answer. You know, Britain, not so much. But trying to explicate all of the stuff, like you mentioned all of these, you know, it affects so many things, even though it seems like maybe it should. It's like saying, okay, explain the Trinity, you know, just explain it so that everyone understands it. Just go up and do it. You can do it.
I was able to do it when Theresa May was prime minister, because you could say, well, you know, the Northern Ireland issue does mean that the UK faces more challenges leaving the EU than another country might face. I mean, there were uniquely difficult circumstances about that. My issue was not that it was wrong to leave the EU. You could make a case for the fact that the UK has always been a slightly awkward, reluctant member of the EU. One could make a case that we would rather be out and sovereign. But you have to be honest with your own people as well as your allies about the consequences of that. And it was the dishonesty of it that got me, and it's the continuing dishonesty of it. We are still in a situation where prime ministers, they don't want to admit some of the negative consequences of Brexit. So they are still trying to say it's a success, and it's warping all British government policy ever since we left the EU, because we are trying to put lipstick on a pig and say it's a success. It's cascading dishonesty through our system. It's had way more damaging effects beyond the actual fact of leaving the EU.
Is Sunak a better prime minister than his predecessors? I mean, Liz Truss was there for less time than that head of lettuce, I guess. Arthur Snell came on this podcast during the brief Liz Truss interregnum there, which is pretty fine. We timed it well. And it didn't last very long. She seemed to be the most oblivious of anybody. But the new prime minister seems at least to be competent. Is that accurate, would you say? Or
I think he's been a real disappointment. I mean, we've had a succession of very poor quality prime ministers. And Brexit is the albatross behind their neck, around their neck, because none of them can admit, as I was just saying, to accepting there were negative consequences to Brexit. Because the Conservative base, the core membership of their party, is the Leaver vote. And right. If they admit that Brexit was a mistake, they instantly alienate. I mean, A, they discredit the basis on which they've built their entire political project for the last 10 years, and they also alienate a vast amount of their constituency. So they can't own up to it. And so prime minister after prime minister has had to just sort of adopt the narrative, we just need to find the right form of Brexit, the sort of purer form of Brexit. It's like communism. It can never be pure enough. And Sunak, like all his predecessors, is now being accused from the right of the party that he just hasn't believed in it enough, delivered it enough, pursued an ideologically coherent version of Brexit enough. And he continues to try and pander to that right wing of the party. So he is going to suffer the same fate that Theresa May has suffered. But like Theresa May, I do feel he's trying to make an honest fist of leading a more competent government. He has appointed a more competent chancellor. I believe he's hardworking. He has quietly, below the radar, dropped some of the more ludicrous proposals, such as instantly to rip up all pre-existing EU legislation and standards. He also quietly negotiated a deal with the EU to try and improve the situation with Northern Ireland. So quietly behind the scenes, he's done quite a lot of sensible things. So yes, I think he's more pragmatic, but he's still bound by that original big lie, the albatross that is Brexit. And he can't break free from that. And in an attempt to win over that extreme right wing of his party, he's also doubling down on another policy, which is warping our politics, which is that there is a magic solution to the flood of immigrants coming across the channel and trying to enter the UK to seek refuge or a better life. And he has doubled down where Boris Johnson campaigned on Get Brexit Done. Rishi Sunak is campaigning on this mantra of stop the boats. And they're doing it by threatening to disrespect elements of the Refugee Convention and potentially breach elements of the European Convention on Human Rights. And this is now the new election slogan. We'll stop the boats. And this is yet another European body that is trying to thwart us and impede our sovereignty. And so he's following down a very nasty path. So he is better in some ways, but fundamentally suffers from the same problems.
Stop the boat sounds like build the wall. I mean, it's the same.
Yeah,
the same
exactly. Kind of it's shallow and facile. It doesn't allow for the nuances of the problem. And it's never going to be enough for the right of the party, just like it's never enough for the right elements of the Republican Party here. So there was a potential deal on the border, which they said they wanted, and it's still not pure enough for them.
Yeah, well, if it's that, they can keep saying that as long as they stay in power. It's just an excuse. But it sounds to me like whenever the next election is, they're going to throw all these guys out, and a new party could come in and say, this was a mistake or this was done badly, but now we're going to make the best of it, and this is what we're going to do, and won't have the albatross around the neck. Is that what's good? When is the election? Nobody seems to, it's confusing to Americans when the elections are in the UK and what is going to happen with the election process.
All right. So it's not clear when the election will be, because unlike in the US, it's not set in stone. It is at the discretion of the government to fix the election date. And once they call the date, you have 6 weeks of campaigning. Thank God we don't have the 2 years of campaigning that you have here. The only absolute deadline is it must take place before the end of January 2025. There are some speculation that it would be unwise to have the British general election around November because we are part of the Five Eyes Security Alliance, and there is a certain mm-hmm. worry that there may be, I hate to say this, but there may be a certain air of unpredictability around the elections in the US. And so there is some sense that having the British also going in an election the same time as the US is a bad idea. So most speculation is any time between May and October, and it's the discretion of the Prime Minister to try and call it when he thinks he has an advantageous moment. Some people think the longer he leaves it, the worse it's going to be for the Tories. Better to cut your losses and call it now. Others say the longer you can push it, the better the chance of the economy beginning to recover a little bit and maybe getting a slightly better grip on the migration issue and calling the election on the back of that. So any time between May and October is my guess.
Okay. Okay, that's good. I agree. It's a terrible idea to do it at the same time as the U.S. election for any number of reasons. I mean, you know, it's already happened where you know, the Russians look at it and like, okay, we're going to do Brexit here and Trump here, and working that in tandem that could end catastrophically for sure. And you mentioned Northern Ireland. That's an issue because there's a real physical border now between the U.K. and the EU, right? That you can't not, you know, reconcile that somehow. So what's going on in Northern Ireland these days? Like, I remember from when I was a kid, you know, that was bad there. There were explosions all the time and, you know, real fighting. So that seems not to have happened for a long time. But are we going to get more of that now because of this, or is everything more settled than it was?
Well, things are certainly a lot better than they were in the 1970s and 80s. And I think the UK, with the huge support of the EU and the US, and of course the government in Ireland, can take some pride in the negotiation of the Good Friday Agreement. And despite huge pressures, it still stands and it has still survived the wrenching process of Brexit. But Brexit has put it under strain and has reawoken this issue of Irish identity again. Because if you are a unionist in Northern Ireland and your affiliation and sense of belonging leans more towards the rest of the United Kingdom, the fact that there is now, it's not a visible border, but a slight distancing between trade across the Irish Sea with the United Kingdom, there is a psychological barrier that has been put in place there. And if you are a Republican or a unionist and your sense of belonging and affinity looks more towards the Republic of Ireland and your Irish identity, you are now in Northern Ireland, technically no longer part of the EU. And so there has been a psychological barrier created there, although thank goodness there is not a physical barrier re-erected in Ireland, and people in Northern Ireland can still travel as freely to and fro between the North and the South. What's also changed is that the Republican Party Sinn Féin has for the first time won a majority. And so the government in Northern Ireland is majority Sinn Féin, and the new leader of that government has declared their wish that there might be a border poll sometime within the next 5 to 10 years about whether or not Northern Ireland should join the Republic of Ireland. Now, the brilliant thing about the Good Friday Agreement was that it dissolved these borders and it dissolved these issues of identity, because you could live in Northern Ireland, you could travel freely with the EU, you could travel freely with the rest of England and Scotland and Wales. In fact, you could be all these identities at once. What happened with Brexit is it's reawoken these issues of identity and put it back on the table again. So I think there are some troubling undercurrents there. But for the time being, not least thanks to Rishi Sunak's agreement to sign a deal with the EU, providing a temporary sort of settlement of these issues, it's been tamped down for a while, but it's bubbling underneath.
Well, we hope that that the bubbling doesn't bubble, you know, and that all of this stuff gets resolved in an amicable way. And I'm optimistic now, hearing that the election is going to be probably sometime, you know, in the not too distant future. Because my sense is that a new prime minister will be good for a lot of different things and how this all winds up getting settled.
Well, I'm also hoping that for the people of Northern Ireland, I mean, that peace is pretty precious. I mean, their economies did much better. And so I'm hoping that all sides will always continue to pull back from the brink. There will always be a few extremist elements, but I think for the majority of people, that Good Friday Agreement is an incredibly precious achievement. Good. So it won't be squandered.
Good, good. You wrote a piece, Byline Times. You have great articles on the Byline Times, by the way.
Thank you.
You wrote a piece about the coronation, which I watched. I wake up early and I'm like, oh, the coronation's on. This is interesting. I was always sort of fascinated by it because there had not been a coronation since, what, 1954, 53, whatever. So anybody involved with the old coronation is either super old or dead, and they'd have to go back to the books. And what are they going to do? And they're going to do this and that. And all this pomp. And, you know, I my day job is working with at a coin place, so I know what these medieval coins look like. And when Charles is sitting there and he's got the Globus Crucifer in one hand and the scepter in the other, and he's doing this pose, that's the pose that, you know, Edward I does on the groat or whatever.
You're so right. Yeah.
It goes back like way. And I'm thinking nobody else watching this is going to know that, but it goes back. So there is a sense that, you know, if we're going to do this thing, it's only every once every 75 years. We might as well just do it. But in your piece, you argued that this was a moment to sort of modernize what the monarchy looks like, which it hasn't really done. It seems like maybe the next coronation is not going to be 75 years in the future, given his health and just his age. So how would you like to see the monarchy modernized? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think there are sort of two strands of thought in the UK. And one is that the pomp and circumstance is what we're best at. And what's the point? If you don't have the pomp and the circumstance and the pageantry and the coming together and the flags and the walking down the mall and the balcony appearances, then what do we have left? And there is a sense that the UK has lost its way, that our public services are crumbling, our politicians are not what they once were. And so the royal family, the worse things get on terms of sort of daily life, the more we cling on to the monarchy and sort of at least we can do these parades and at least we can do pageantry like nobody else in the world. And what's the point? We don't actually want a Scandinavian monarchy sort of bicycling to work and, you know, being sort of every man. But I personally, I mean, I can't believe this because I was Her Majesty's ambassador and I have no personal animus against individual members of the royal family. I think on a personal level, we've been pretty lucky with who we've got.
Yeah.
But I personally have, to my shock, become a Republican because I feel the monarchy holds us back. It holds us in thrall. It fuels the British obsession with class. There would not be a House of Lords if we did not have a monarchy, But because we have a monarchy, we have dukes, we have earls, we have lords and ladies and countesses. And it just is just a nonsense. And I didn't actually watch the coronation. I did watch the Queen's funeral because I served and grew up my entire life under her shadow. And I think she was amazing. And I was sad about her death. And it felt like the end of an era. I did not watch the coronation because it was just totally over the top. And it just looked silly. I mean, I saw the photos of it. And even they looked a bit silly in their ridiculous hats and orbs and scepters and swords. And it's like, really? And I feel there could have been a sort of middle way. I mean, Charles said he was going to rule in a sort of slightly different way and modernize the economy and cut back the size of it. And yet he throws himself the mother of all coronations, the most expensive one in history, with every single trapping. And there was the sort of the footman of the glove and the bearer of the sword and all these ridiculous titles. And I mean, you still could have had some dignity to it, but it did not need to be this ostentatious. And we have had a cost of living crisis. We have food banks, we have homelessness, we have people who can't afford to buy their first house. And just there was a jarringness of it. And the difficulty we have in the UK is it's very difficult to have a really open conversation about the monarchy because the media thrives on the existence of the monarchy. There is an unhealthy relationship between the government, the media, and the monarchy. The monarchy, in return for giving the media access, gets sort of soft porn coverage of it. The media gets to fill its pages with glossy images of the monarchy and fawning stories, and that sells newspapers. And the government, of course, loves it because it's bread and circuses and it's a distraction. And if you dare criticize the monarchy, you're not a patriot, you're a traitor. And why do Harry and Meghan get so much hatred? It's because Harry and Meghan have tried to turn their back on that. And they've also tried to call out the collusion between the palace and the media. And they're trying to expose that. And the media have just turned on Harry and Meghan in a way that is absolutely shocking. I'm not saying I approve of everything Harry and Meghan have done, but they certainly don't deserve the vitriol that they get.
They seem like they're more fun to hang out with than the rest anyway, so. If I had to choose who I was going to go have a beer with, I would go in that direction, I think, rather than.
Yeah, no comment. No comment. I mean, we all used to absolutely love Harry. And in the public events that I've seen that Meghan did, I mean, she's smart and she's engaging and they seem like a very nice couple. And I think their initiative, Harry's initiative of the Invictus Games, was absolutely brilliant. There used to be soldiers from Georgia who used to take part in that, and it was an absolute highlight. I think it was amazing, some of what they've done. And they get pounded. So when the king was diagnosed with cancer, you had almost within days, you had the press saying, Harry's flown over because it's all self-publicity. But also, Harry and Meghan haven't come because they don't care about him. And then, inevitably, was the king's cancer triggered by the stress over Harry and Meghan? It's now their fault that he's ill. I mean, they cannot do anything right.
Yeah, they're going to just beat them up no matter what they say.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, it'll be interesting. Even there, it'll be interesting. I do feel like we're at this time where the world in general is just at this turn the page moment. I really get that sense. Like even Queen Elizabeth comes in and her prime minister is Winston Churchill and she goes out and her prime minister is Liz Truss.
I mean, that is awful.
But
at least she saw off Boris Johnson.
Yeah. This is true.
I mean, I'm really glad it wasn't Boris Johnson presiding over all of this. I mean, the guy has a head the size of a watermelon. This would have exploded it. But, you know, I think, you know, I'm very sorry the king has cancer. And I mean, I think he has tried to be a decent occupant of his position. If, very sadly, this cancer takes a serious turn for the worse and we're faced with a new coronation within the next few years, I don't think there's any way it can be justified as being as huge and as over the top as the last one. And I think Prince William and Kate, I hope, will go for a slightly more lower key one. I hope anyway. If they're sensible, if they want to keep their heads, I think they should.
A millennial coronation.
Yeah.
Going to be interesting. Okay, so I want to talk about diplomacy a little bit. I know we're getting up on time. I don't want to keep you too long, but the whole idea of what diplomats do on the day-to-day, especially in war zones and in moments of crisis, is something I've been thinking about lately. Obviously, the Israel-Hamas war is horrifying, and I think, you know, looking at it, sensible people come to the thing that Hamas is bad, Bibi has handled this horribly, and, you know, supported Hamas initially, and going with the settlements in the West Bank, and he's just made everything worse, and those are the two parties now that are in charge of what's going on. And how do you manage that? The Israeli people clearly don't like Bibi. You know, the Hamas has not done well, Lord knows now, tragically, for the residents of Gaza. But those are the powers that be. So how does somebody like the President of the United States and the Secretary of State manage a situation like that when you have these two forces that really, really want to go to war and fight each other constantly? How, you know, what are they supposed to do? I guess I'm looking at, there's a lot of criticism of Biden, right, in the country. There's the hashtag Genocide Joe, as if he's sitting in the White House saying, hey, guys, let's do this thing. Like, my take is that Biden obviously he doesn't want mass death. I think that's clear. He's, say what you want about him, he's a good person. He's a decent human. And I don't think he wants to see people suffer. But I'm going back in time now and looking at what he's done and the criticisms of him, and thought, what could he have done differently along the way that would have been better, that would have arrived at a solution that freed the hostages, that curtailed Bibi's bloodthirst in Gaza, and you know, the first thing he flies to Israel on the day or the second day after the attacks and gives the speech. Warns in the speech about 9/11, don't do the Iraq thing, please. Meets with the hostage families, you know, all this stuff, and gives his support to the Israeli people, which that's good. We want that. I think if you know, they're our ally and they've had this horrible tragedy. And then I think has been trying to, you know, rein in Bibi diplomatically through diplomatic channels and, you know, have pauses to get the hostages out and negotiate. And even the criticism of him giving aid to Israel, which, you know, do they need it? Do they not? If he doesn't give aid to Israel, if he just says, we're not doing this, then he has no power over Bibi at all and no influence at all. And Bibi can say, well, the U.S. screwed us over. We're going to do what we want now. So I guess looking at it from a diplomat's point of view, how is he? Am I off base thinking that he's been handling this well? Like, what has he done right? What has he done wrong? What's your take on just the job that he's been doing? Or the, you know, the State Department?
Well, of course, part of the problem is, you know, you've inherited a situation. I mean, looking back, we should never have allowed the situation between Israel and the Palestinians to have got this bad in the first place. And we were all guilty of going along with kind of what Israel had achieved and thinking it had just kept a lid on the Palestinians. And we had allowed ourselves to look away. And there is the famous fact that Jake Sullivan said, the Middle East has never been more at peace than it was now. And we took our eye off the ball. And where we are today is a result of decades of failed policy. Israel should never have been allowed to hold on to the occupation for as long as it had. It should never have been allowed to keep building settlements for as long as it had. It should never have been allowed to apply military law to Palestinian civilians and put people in prison for throwing stones. By the same token, The Palestinian Authority should not have been allowed to crumble along with this aging, useless leader that it has, who has not faced a proper election challenge in almost 20 years. And we should never have allowed Hamas to consolidate its grip in Gaza. So you've ended up in a situation where you have to deal with the card, you know, you play the cards you've got. And I think Biden's response, his decision to fly to Israel to meet the hostages' families before Netanyahu himself did, and express that empathy and that sense of grief in a way that touched the hearts of Israelis who had suffered this appalling attack, and his very wise words about don't make the mistakes that we did. So I think his handling in the immediate aftermath was absolutely perfect. And I think all of us immediately knew the moment the shocking details of the attack on 7th of October came out that, of course, Israel was going to respond. I think it did take Biden too long to understand that Netanyahu was going to go in with absolutely no restraint at all. I mean, the rate of deaths has slightly slowed down, but in those first few weeks, I mean, it was sort of the thousands were ticking up almost by the week. I mean, the sheer scale of that initial invasion was absolutely shocking. So I think it took too long, if I'm being critical, for Biden to wake up to just how ferocious the Israeli assault was going to be. So I think it took Biden too long to wake up to the scale of the assault and the extent to which, you know, was this a proportionate response consistent with international law? I mean, we've all known that Netanyahu is an extremist. We all know that his government has ministers who have nakedly nationalistic sentiments and who have openly advocated for pushing Palestinians out, and who even more recently have advocated reoccupying Gaza and removing Palestinians. And I think Biden could have been far more strident about that. And we do have leverage over Israel. I do think, given the scale of the assault, there is a question about the extent to which we should be continuing to supply Israel with weapons, and weapons that will be used against Palestinians unless you are absolutely convinced it's being used in a proportionate way. And we now have a threat that there will be an attack on Rafah, the last remaining so-called safe place for Palestinian civilians. We're talking 1.5 million people in that area. And Netanyahu has not spelled out a plan for the post-war management of Gaza, the post-war situation for Palestinians. He has not criticized the statements of his national security advisor, his national security minister. You have extremist settlers using the distraction of the war in Gaza to move on Palestinian property in East Jerusalem. You have seen an escalation of attacks in the West Bank. So I'm not sure anybody can stop Netanyahu, because Netanyahu is fighting for his political survival. But you certainly don't need to be complicit. And some of what they're doing is beyond what might be considered a legitimate response. Heinous though the awful attack was on the 7th of October, and ghastly and anguishing the situation of the hostages are. And I want there to be no doubt, I'm absolutely not an apologist for Hamas, and they should never have been allowed to dig in the way they have. But I think Biden could be calling out, we will not supply you these arms unless you give us some more coherent answers about how you're going to avoid, you know, vast civilian casualties, what your plans are, what is your long-term strategy. We apply conditions to the supply of weapons to anybody around the world. I mean, the US was not shy to warn the UK, if you go ahead with this form of Brexit and you do not handle this Northern Ireland situation well, there will be consequences for our relationship with you. They did that to the UK. Why are we so afraid of Israel? Why can we not apply certain clear conditions to our support for Israel? So I do think Biden has, you know, his immediate response was absolutely the right one. And there are no easy cards to play here.
Yeah.
And I'm filled with admiration for Blinken's tireless diplomacy here. And William Burns, you know, I know they're doing the best they can, but do we have a, it's often been said, we've not had a proper partner in the Palestinian side. And I think that's a fair criticism. I could talk for hours about the failures on the Palestinian side and the moral degradation of Hamas. But do we have a partner in the current Israeli government?
Well, it's not Bibi. And Bibi is incentivized to continue the war until he dies, basically, because as soon as the war is over, he's going to be removed and he's going to wind up in jail. You know, because he's a crook. So as soon as this happened, it was the first thing that I thought. But to your point, and I agree, do you think that Blinken and the diplomats are making the point that you made privately? Like, and that they're waiting to, and this is what I'm legitimately asking because I don't know how this works. Do you think that they're pushing the Israelis privately, the things that you said, and are waiting for Biden to say something publicly? Because there have been rumblings lately publicly that Biden is, you know, maybe going to be a little more hard ass with the treatment there. I mean, how does it work?
Absolutely. I'm sure there are some very difficult conversations going on behind the scenes. And that's what allies do. I mean, Israel is a democracy. It is a beleaguered democracy. It has faced, and it continues to face, rocket attacks. So, of course, the Israeli people, when you feel under threat, you're going to tend to come together. You're going to tend to be defensive. You're going to tend to resent criticisms when you've suffered what you've suffered. But I'm absolutely sure there are some tough messages and tough conversations going on behind the scenes. And you asked what the role of diplomats is. I mean, Blinken, in British terms, is really, you know, he's a political figure. He's not a career diplomat. He's a political figure. The role of diplomats is, it's not for us to deliver these tough messages. We're not the ones who knock heads together. But what we do is we brief the principals and we use our knowledge and our understanding and our conversations at a lower level. All of that coalesces into a briefing for the president about the sentiment in Israel, about what the pressure points on Netanyahu are, what arguments might, you know, have sway on him. So diplomats aren't the negotiators. They're not the deal breakers, but they are the ones who help the principals understand and prepare the principals for those conversations. And so, yes, I'm sure behind the scenes, there are some very tough conversations. And it's not just Blinken, it's across the region. Diplomats will be talking to the Saudis and the Qataris and the Emiratis and the Turks and the Egyptians and trying to sort of keep that communication going so that, you know, if Biden decides he needs to go more public or more forceful or take more stronger action. But Biden's hands are also a little bit tied, unfortunately, because he's now facing an election and he's facing pressures. I mean, the Israeli-Palestinian issue seems to galvanize people around the world in a way that other heinous situations like in Sudan or Yemen or Burma don't seem to galvanize protests on the street. Some people would say that is because of anti-Semitism, and I'm sure there's a degree to which that's true. Some would say it's because it's a sort of festering sore. It's like a sort of civilizational crash. And we sort of kind of, it resonates with people. And it is an ally of ours, Israel, which is conducting these raids in Gaza that are resulting in the huge suffering of Palestinians. So that brings people out. But Biden, you know, he has to worry about his constituencies. And there is a large diaspora of Arabs in certain swing states. And then there are many Jewish citizens of America who will have feelings and views about this. So he has to tread very carefully. And the aid to Israel is now also caught up in the politics about aid to Ukraine and to Taiwan as well. And there's a lot of sympathy for Israel in Congress. If he tried to say, I'm going to sort of be tougher on Israel, does that kibosh the aid to Ukraine and make it even harder to get that passed? So unfortunately, there's politics tying their hands here as well.
Ooh, thank you for that answer. That's really good. Because I know this is complicated stuff. I have two more questions quickly. Ukraine, Navalny is now dead. Putin has killed him, according to Biden, directly or indirectly. This happened the week of the Tucker Carlson interview. It happened the week that Trump started yammering about NATO. It happened when Trump had the judgment handed down on him. It happened when all the world leaders, including Navalny's wife, were gathered in Munich. The timing is definitely of interest. What do you think is going to happen now with that? Like, I could see it going either way. I could see this being a red line that once crossed will galvanize opinion against Putin even more. I don't know why we need more galvanizing for this guy, how many more people he has to kill, or elections he has to tamper with, or lives he has to ruin. But apparently, yes, with the Republicans there. Or it could be that, no, we're not going to do anything. And then Putin knows that I can get away with this and nobody's going to do anything. So all I have to do is keep on holding out. And these, you know, the Americans will lose interest. The Europeans will lose interest. And that's how it's going to go. What's your sense on just world opinion of this one thing that happened?
I'm horrified to say I don't think anything's going to change. I think it's yet another red line. And Putin has crossed red line after red line after red line after red line. And we express outrage, we condemn, we wring our hands, we say this is awful, we're not going to put up with it. And yet, again, we're not going to apply sufficient consequences. The guy obviously feels he can get away with it. I mean, he invaded an entire country.
Right.
And what's so sad to me is a year ago at the Munich Security Conference, it felt like we were at a turning point in a really strong direction. The Ukrainians didn't roll over. They mounted a plucky defense. They survived this winter when the Russians bombed their heating and water and infrastructure, and they suffered through that winter. Their morale was high. The EU and NATO came together. Biden was leading this alliance. We were pouring money into Ukraine, and we all hoped for this spring offensive. Finland and Sweden had applied to join NATO. It really looked like, actually, hey, the world is getting its shit together, that actually what Putin did has galvanized us. It's given renewed purpose. It's reminded us of the values of freedom and democracy. Zelensky was articulating it. He appeared at Congress and was cheered to the rafters. And I thought a year ago, despite the darkness of the invasion of Ukraine, I felt really optimistic. It's like, wow, there's juice in us and we've rediscovered our mojo. And I can't believe it. Now I feel we're at a dangerous turning point the other way. We're at an unhinging point where we have the front runner for the Republican nomination openly saying that he would not support other members in NATO if they continued to fail to contribute at least 2% of GDP towards their defense. That is undoing the cornerstone of what has provided our security for 75 years, which is an attack on one is an attack on all. And it is giving a green light to Putin that America may not come to the aid of a NATO country if it's invaded. If I was a Baltic country, I would be shitting bricks right now because he has basically just given a green light. Then you have the killing of Navalny. Putin obviously thinks he can do that. I mean, unfortunately, I think Navalny was dead man walking ever since he returned in this act of unbelievable courage when he returned to Russia despite having been poisoned. The point about the killing of Navalny is it's a message to anyone in Russia: don't you dare cross me. this is what's going to happen. I killed my former Wagner associate. I can kill Navalny. We have Vladimir Karamurza in prison. Jason and I interviewed his wife a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sure she is absolutely terrified for the safety of her family. And Biden, yes, he's condemned Putin for killing Navalny. Of course, Putin is guilty of Navalny's death. But Biden was already rowing back. A journalist asked him, you know, so what are you now going to do? You said that if Navalny died in one of Russia's prisons, this would result in more consequences. And Biden's answer was, yeah, well, I said that a few years ago. We've already since applied all these consequences, sanctions and weapons to Ukraine. You know, what has it got? The only thing I hope is it finally gets the stupid House of Representatives to get their act together and pass that damn act. And I also hope it galvanizes this administration to send Ukraine the ATACMS that it needs, the high-intensity weapons that it's needed. The Ukrainian armed forces, they've had the ability to devastate Russian forces in the Crimea and cut off Crimea from the rest of Ukraine. Get your damn act together. Get those weapons to Ukraine. That's the best thing we can do to respond to the death of Navalny, is get that damn money and that damn weaponry to Ukraine. And if we don't, it will confirm my worst fear that we've lost our mojo. It's awful. And as for Tucker Carlson, I do not have the words to describe him on this podcast. He is the Lord Hor-Hor of the 21st century. I mean, the cravenness, the corruption, the moral degradation, the lack of perspective, the apologist for tyranny. I mean, it is simply shocking to me. And I remember talking to a senior American general a few months ago, and he said what really shocks him about where we're heading in this country is not that Trump is running again, but what has happened to our country that so many people are buying his stuff. It's terrifying. And I'm afraid, you know, I'm not going to make any bones about this. I tend to be a centrist. I'm not extreme left. I'm certainly not a sort of a woke lefty. I have voted left and right in my past. But yes, I agree with Biden on this one. This election is going to be the most consequential of our lifetime. And we need to understand that if Donald Trump becomes president, we need to take him at his face value, as we should have taken Putin at his face value over the years. Trump, if he becomes president again, he will try to take the US out of NATO. He will not come to the defense of allies. He will renege on climate change, and the world will be in a very, very dangerous place. I'm really sorry. I hope your last question is about football.
It is.
Thank God.
I was going to say, now we're going to talk about something important.
Yes.
Thank you for that. Yeah, no, this is such a crazy time. I was happy to find out that you're a fan of football. American football, the fun kind, the entertaining kind, where stuff happens, where points get scored and stuff like that. So you're a fan of the Ravens. When the playoffs started, I said to my son, Lamar Jackson chokes in big games. They're not going to beat the Chiefs. And I was right. So what do you think is going to happen with the Ravens next year? What's the what's your forecast?
Well, it's like the British soccer team, the English soccer team taking penalty shootouts. The English soccer team is notorious for choking when it comes to penalty shootouts. And unfortunately, the fact that the Kansas City Chiefs just wiped the Ravens out in the semi-final is going to create a psychological burden over the Ravens. I think they have a brilliant quarterback in Lamar Jackson. He was MVP for a reason. It is that psychological hang-up. And so much was riding on this semi-final. It was the biggest game that had ever been hosted in Baltimore. The Ravens had played brilliantly through the season. And I think all that hype and all that pressure and that sort of psychological barrier in their heads is ultimately what let them down. And almost immediately, the game started just kind of in the body language. The Kansas City Chiefs, they just looked sort of unstoppable, unflappable. There was just an air of inevitability about them, which they replicated in the Super Bowl against an absolutely brilliant 49ers and brilliant play by Brock Purdy. But the Kansas City Chiefs, they just looked inevitable. And the Ravens just looked a little bit desperate and they made silly mistakes. And it's those nerves. And I play tennis and I know what it feels like to, you've just got to serve it out. You're at set point. You're at match point. You've just got to serve it out. And your muscles just don't do what they've been trained to do. So the issue isn't the physical skills or the game plan of the Ravens. It's the psychological headspace that they're in. And if I was their coach, that's what I would be trying to work on.
Lamar's still young. He's too good not to win one of these sooner or later. So Alexandra Hall-Hall, thanks so much for taking the time with me today. This was great.
Thank you so much for having me on.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fawcett. Serena Zabriskie, Marie Cast, and Martha Acuna provided the introduction in Ukrainian, French, and Spanish, respectively. Voice talent is by Stephanie St. John and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, Kimberly Johnson, and everyone else at MSW Media. If you'd like to support this program, get three friends to subscribe. The more downloads I get, the better the show does. You can also subscribe to The 5-8, the live YouTube show I do with my friend Stephanie Koff, a.k.a. LB. Tune in tonight for your Friday night hang. Most importantly, please subscribe to The Prevail Substack with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $6 monthly or $55 yearly subscription funds my work on the column and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Be kind to each other. Try and enjoy yourself. And until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW Media.